So first of all, let me thank the coordinators for having organized such an interesting meeting in such an important historical moment for the US. So what I'm going to talk about is the Casimir...
When we invited you, did we tell you it's election
day? Yeah. Of course. And for Halloween at the Isla Vista, no? The two things were... Okay. So what I'm going to talk about is the Casimir effect, which arises due to the fluctuations occurring close to a second order phase transition point, that is to a critical point. So I will tell you how you can put these critical fluctuations at work in soft matter systems and play with femtonewton forces. And then I will focus on some recent theoretical and experimental work we have done in Stuttgart. And I hope that by the end of the talk I will have convinced you that these forces are important, might be of importance for the physics of colloids and soft matter physics in general. But let me start, however, by recalling how and why the Casimir effect in statistical physics is related to his more famous analogous in quantum electrodynamics. So I will first start by recalling briefly what the fundamental work of Casimir in quantum electrodynamics, then I will tell you how these effects arises due to critical fluctuations, and then at the end I will show you what we have, I mean, among others, what we have done in Stuttgart in terms of both theoretical prediction and experiments. I have to say that in this presentation it's meant to provide you a sort of overview, general overview, also in a sense a little bit pedagogical, while you can find a thorough discussion of what I'm going to say in the two or three lectures, I don't even remember, that Dietrich gave here with all details and everything, okay? So, I mean, all of us know that 60 years ago, Henry Casimir discovered that surprisingly, if you take two metallic plates, uncharged, perfectly conducting, you put them in vacuum, they attract each other even at zero temperature due to the quantum fluctuations of the electromagnetic fields in vacuum, okay? So this is the well-known Casimir effect we are talking about, okay? And why does this effect arise? Well, basically because the plates, the perfectly conducting plates, impose effectively boundary conditions on the fluctuating field and on the electromagnetic fields, and therefore the fluctuation modes in the space in between the two walls can have only a certain set of L-dependent, where L is the distance between the two walls, L-dependent modes. And roughly speaking, if you want, the imbalance between the pressure exerted on the wall by the allowed modes within the cavity and the pressure exerted by the unrestricted modes from outside the cavity is at the origin of the Casimir effect. Okay? How do we see it? Well, I mean, we calculate the energy of the vacuum, or the fields, the electromagnetic fields in vacuum, in the space in between the two walls, which is the sum over the modes of the expression given by electrodynamics. We know that this expression in principle is divergence. You need to somehow model the plates. Huh? You put in a model, Casimir was doing it by assuming a sort of cutoff at high frequency, and then you end up with a certain expression for the energy. Now you assume that the transverse area of the plates is very, very large, and you can decompose this energy in decreasing powers of the separation between the two walls. And when you do so, can you see here? Okay. When you do so, you find that there is a term, which is the bulk energy, which scales as the volume of the space contained within the cavity, and which is the energy that would be in the space even without the presence of the wall, okay? You can imagine like this. Then there is a term which is due to the energy necessary to introduce each single wall separately in the vacuum, and actually this energy scales only as the size of as the area of the plates, and is independent, of course, of the distance of the wall. And then you get a just a bleeding term, which scales like this, which is basically the energy of, you can interpret this as the interaction energy between the two walls, because it's just the energy for, due to the fact that you have the two walls at the same time in vacuum. And this term takes this form. I mean, this form here can be even guessed by dimensional analysis. And there is this sort of number. And as you can see, this number is basically independent, is completely independent of the properties, the material properties of the walls, which are confined in the fields. And the material properties only set this value of kappa here, which is giving you the correction. If you want, these are the finite conductivity corrections. And then, of course, material properties are expected to enter here. And also, this bulk energy now is going to depend on how you treat, you regularize your expression. Okay? So when you do, when you, in a field theoretical perspective, you have no problems if these two objects contains divergences. And the important thing is that this object is finite. Okay? So now the question is, as presented here, basically we are interested in the third term of an expansion as a function of the size. So the question is this term really observable? I mean, can we measure it? Okay. Well, we can measure in the sense we can take two parallel plates that given this, I mean, this is how a theoretician would measure it, not an experimentalist. So you take two parallel plates at a distance L, then what you do, you shift slightly one of the two plates. And then you expect that given that the energy depends on the distance between the two walls, there is a force associated to the variation of energy. And by using the previous, the composition as I showed you before for the energy, the first term is giving a bulk force which is L independent, okay, which is the force of the vacuum in itself, if you want. The second term drops out, because which is the surface term, because it's L independent, and then you get an additional, the remaining part is giving you a Casimir force, which actually is the force, the net force acting on the wall, if you take into account that the bulk term is counterbalanced from the modes, unrestricted modes from outside, okay? And when you take the expression, you find that the Casimir force has this expression here, provided that you measure it, so which is universal, so you see there are no material dependent properties here, but provided that the separation between the two walls is much larger than the material dependent scale set by your system. So here you are probably, technically speaking, the infrared behavior of your theory, and you need to go at very large scales in order to see the universal behavior, okay? In this sense, the prediction of Casimir is nice because it's universal. Okay. Now the question is, how large is this k to minus 1? Because if it's 10 meters, we are talking about nothing. Okay. Well, actually, I mean, I'm not in the serious business, but you can estimate by relating this to the plasma frequency. And if you do it for copper, you find that it's over the order of 0.3 micron, which is actually the range at which the so-called finite conductivity corrections basically die, okay? And, I mean, all of you know that just after 10 years after Casimir, basically the first investigation started, but a complete experimental picture and the reliable data came only much later in this range of distances, okay? So you know that there is a whole activity, I mean, you know for sure much better than me that there is a whole activity about this the Casimir effect in quantum electrodynamics, even in view of possible applications, technological applications, microelectromechanical systems, and so on. And here I only cite sort of mentioned pedagogical reviews.
Just a general question. Why is there such a cultural comfort ignoring all the work that was material-based? All the Russian work, all the work that came through there. I could see somebody saying this, you know, in 1958, but I had trouble saying this.
No. I'm not saying that there is not. I mean, what is here, what I call correction, is actually nice.
Nice is the dominant.
And is important. What I'm saying is, I'm interested because I have to make contact with what I'm going to do later on. I'm interested only in the universal behavior. And the universal behavior sets where the work in the 50s are irrelevant. I should not have recorded this. Okay?
You mentioned real materials That's why I asked my question.
Yeah. No, I mean, real materials, from my point of view, are entering here and here. Huh? The materials are here. But I'm going to go to stay in a range which...
The problem is that this is in the range where you want to go, that thermal correction starts
I know, I know. I mean, this is just to make a long story. I mean, I told you, you know this story much better than me. This was just a way of rereading what Casimir did, which is serving my purposes, okay?
Basically, this is a nasty question to the same point. Whether somebody read this Casimir paper?
Yes, I read it. I mean, that's why...
I would appreciate if you could send me, because
four-page
paper.
Yeah, I know, but it's introvable.
No, I have it, and actually, I mean, that's why. I mean, I can tell you in detail how this comes. I think I have some slides somewhere in my computer. But I rewrote... Casimir actually was not even looking at these two terms, but I needed to look at them.
Just on the wiki, so that everybody...
Yeah, the basic
Ah, but I don't know for copyright. Ah, with Wiki space here. No, but there are copyright issues.
Book, there is a basic derivation as Casimir did.
Well, okay, but anyhow, I read it and reviewed it.
You can link from your talk, right?
Yeah. From my talk, you can link to all of these. Right?
Okay. So this was it. I mean, again, I'm not. There is lots of physics here. Huh? Finite conductivity, temperature. There are many things. Okay. So, and actually, when the experiment is probing this formula, many things have to be taken into account. Otherwise, you have no chance to see this behavior. But I'm going to be interested in universal behavior. For you see this plus one plus correction related to the finite conductivity plus correction if you want due to finite temperature. So it's a more complicated stuff. But again, this is not, I mean, this was just a way of preparing my room.
You can see the exponent 4. I mean,
no, actually, in this paper for Lamoureux and Bressy, they see it. Yeah. This is seen. I mean, you have to take into account correction, and that where much of the debate was about.
Even if the match is not perfect, but there was.
Your paper's 3.7.
3.7, okay.
Well, 3.7 is 4, come on. Okay, so let me go on. This was just to set the stage, yeah, because what I'm going to talk about is completely different. So, no, just to give you the idea why, I mean, because there is an idea of universality behind this, which is not everything, but is a major part. 30 years after Casimir, in 1978, Michael Fisher, the late Pierre-Gilles Dejeune, they wrote a paper about the phenomena which occurs at the walls in a critical binary mixture. And basically, based on this paper, they realized that you can have Casimir-like effects even in statistical physics. Now, just given that most of the audience here is interested in the Casimir effect in quantum electrodynamics, now I will try to be really pedagogical, so go element by element. So what I'm going to tell you is, what is a binary mixture, what is a critical binary mixture, and how a binary mixture is behaving when you have walls, okay? And then from there, I mean, I will draw the analogy with the Casimir effect in quantum electrodynamics, okay? So, what is a binary mixture? I mean, you take two substances, A and B, two fluids, for example, you mix them in a container. Here I show the possible phase diagram of such a binary mixture as a function of the two relevant thermodynamic parameters, that is temperature and concentration. Let's say concentration of one of the two components, if you want the mole fraction of component A. And this diagram is given, let's say, at room pressure, okay? So what happens is you take these two substances, you mix them with a given concentration, let's say this value here. You mix them in a test tube. When you are at low temperature, you get a sort of homogeneous solution. It looks like, I mean, you say homogeneous. But then when you increase the temperature, at a certain moment you go through a first order phase transition in which the two components demixes. So you end up in your test tube. Usually you have also a separation due to gravity. You end up in your test tube with having an A-rich phase, A-rich solution, a solution which is rich in A component and a solution which is rich in B component, corresponding to these two points, okay? And this phase transition is first order. I mean, usually, this is kind of phase diagram like here is for this the mixture which have a so-called lower critical point, okay? Because it's like this. Usually you expect to have homogeneous solution at high temperature. This means that this diagram is closing somewhere up here, okay? So this transition first order and becomes second order when you approach the critical point. How do you distinguish between this phase and this phase? A possibility is to look at the order parameter of the safe phase transition that in this case can be associated with the local concentration of one of the two components compared to some reference value. Why you look at this object? Because when you are in the homogeneous phase, the local concentration, the thermal average of the local concentration of the of one of the components is constant in space. Why when you look at here, you have two values depending, I mean, of course, this value is larger when you are here and is smaller when you are here, okay? And what we know about the correlation of the fluctuations of this order parameter is that generically decays exponentially fast in time, in space, the space correlation. But we know that the critical point is special because upon approaching it, this correlation length diverges. So this is, and from the work of Landau and so on, we know that upon approaching the critical point, the relevant quantity in order to determine the physics of your system is provided by the order parameter. So the fluctuations of the order parameter are those who are giving you the physics of your system, okay? So this is the global picture. We have a fluctuating quantity, which is the order parameter. Now, I told you what is a mixture, what is the critical point. Now, let me tell you, I mean, what we expect when we put a wall in such a binary mixture. So you imagine you have this container, A and B, and then you take a silica glass, and you immerse you put it in this mixture. Well, actually, you expect Purman approach that the two components A and B will have different interaction with the glass, and as a result, there is high chance that one of the two components is going to be preferred by the glass. So, in a sense, the presence of the glass is enhancing the order parameter at the wall, and this effectively translates into boundary conditions for the order parameter. Okay, so we have also the boundary condition. Now, the analogy is easy, okay? So when we discuss the Casimir effect in quantum electrodynamics, the fluctuating quantities are the electromagnetic fields. The excitations, if you want, of these fields are of quantum origin. We are in a vacuum state, and let me assume that we are at zero temperature. And the typical scale of the system is set by h-bar quantum and c electrodynamics, okay? The range of fluctuation is infinite, because if you calculate the two-point correlation function of the electromagnetic fields in vacuum, it's decaying algebraically, so this means infinite range of fluctuations, or if you want, this is nothing but fact that the photon has zero mass. When you confine these fluctuations by inserting something in your vacuum, you end up with long-range forces acting on the confining walls. So this is more or less the philosophical...
Energy scale, you should have some scale. HT, it's not energy.
Yeah, yeah. I said energy. No, the fundamental scale, okay? Fundamental scale is HC. Actually...
H omega would be nice.
Yeah, well, what's going to the power of the force is the behavior of the force with the size is basically dimensionally determined by this. Okay. Now, in statistical physics, we have also a fluctuating quantity, as I was telling you before, is the order parameter of the phase transition, and this order parameter, in the case I was telling you before, is the local concentration of the field for the binary mixtures. If you take another phase transition, then it's going to be some different physical quantity. For example, it's going to be later on the superfluid order parameter. The excitations are of thermal classical nature, okay? So here, in general, h-bar plays no role, so you can imagine h-bar equals zero. The energy scale now is really given by the thermal energy associated with thermal fluctuation, that is kBT. But at variance with the case of quantum electrodynamics, now the range of fluctuations is finite. We know that it diverges the critical point, so you can make it as large as you want when you approach the critical point, but it's finite. When you confine these fluctuations, then you will end up with a force which has a range set by the correlation length and which becomes long range at the critical point. As you can see in this column here, we can nicely play with the range of the force, huh? Something that you cannot do on the other column.
Sir, okay? That's probably a stupid question. What plays the role of the mass and the case of the order parameter?
The inverse correlation length.
Ah, the correlation.
Okay. No. Actually, the renormalized version that is the correlation. Okay. So, now how do we see this effect in critical phenomena? Okay. You imagine you have your critical medium, which can be pure helium 4, as it was discussed or an helium 4 helium 3 mixture, as it was discussed also yesterday by Raffaello or by Professor Chan long ago. It can be a liquid binary mixture. It can be a Bose gas close to the Bose-Einstein condensation. It can be a liquid crystal, as also Raffaello was discussing. Yes, it can be whatever you like, a critical medium. Huh? And then whatever you take this medium and you confine it in a certain volume. Okay? Imagine, just to keep the ideas fixed, that we are considering the binary mixture, okay? The binary mixture I showed before, and we are working the critical value of the concentration, so that by rising the temperature, we hit the critical point. Now, what we know is that if the size of the system and the correlation length are much larger than the microscopic scales set by the molecular scale, this is analogous to what I was telling before for the quantum electrodynamics. You have to go at scale much larger than the microscopic scale set by your system. The free energy, which can be calculated within a Landau approach, decomposes for large transverse area and by expanding it in decreasing powers of the separation between the two walls, as we did for the Casimir energy, in a bulk term, which is the energy due to the fact that you have a material in your space, independently of the fact that you have the two walls, an energy due to the insertion of each single wall in the medium, plus a term which is again can be interpreted as the interaction energy. So this is the so-called critical Casimir term. And now you see that due to the fact that we have a different scale available, the power, the dependence of this term from L is changed. So before it was h bar c divided L cube, now we have kbt divided L square. And before we had here a universal number. It was minus pi square divided, I don't remember what. Now is a function of the ratio between the size of the system and the bulk correlation length. And this is telling you that the range of the interaction between the two walls is set by the correlation length, which is finite. And we know that it diverges in a universal way upon approaching the critical point. And here again we have correction which depends on the microscopic scales involved in your system. But we are going to be interested in this term. Again, can we measure it? Yes, we play the same trick as before. Now we are going to have a force given by the derivative of the free energy. And again, the force bulk plus Casimir. The bulk part is compensated if you imagine that your wall is completely immersed in your fluctuating medium. And this is the form that you get at the end for the Casimir pressure on the wall. Okay? Again, kbt divided L cube instead of L4, universal function. Now, the nice thing is that this function is universal. In which sense? In the sense of critical phenomena. In the sense of critical phenomena means that what actually determines theta are not the specific microscopic details of your system, exactly as before in Casimir case, the constant was independent of these details, but are only some gross features of your system. Gross features like the dimensionality, the range of interaction within your system. Then, of course, it also depends on some gross features of the boundaries, which actually translate in the kind of effective boundary conditions that these boundaries are imposing on the order parameter. Then, for example, it depends also on the shaping principle of the boundaries, but from now on, I will focus on the case of parallel plates, okay? And this is telling you that Given that this theta parallel depends only on gross features of your model, of your system, instead of studying the actual system that you are going to investigate in the lab, you can study equivalently a much simpler model, which, for example, lends itself for analytic calculation, molecular or Monte Carlo simulations. So instead of going to the lab and measure this, you go in the computer room.
Can I ask one question? No. We heard last week from Jeff, who put some weight in the electrodynamic Casimir calculation about the properties of the materials. Can one in the real electrodynamic Casimir calculation introduce a universal function that contains a bit more information than just the number?
Well, actually, the problem is that...
He was essentially pointing out that with this strong coupling limit, the Casimir thing is a strong coupling limit, so the E squared of finite structure constants.
I mean, first of all...
One resumes better the electrodynamic case in real material properties with a scaling function.
Look, first of all, you see the scaling function here is depending on Xi.
Okay.
Yeah, in the case of quantum electrodynamics, Xi is infinite.
Well, I mean,
so you end up with a number.
He was talking about the plasma wavelength.
And yeah, but then you go against this prescription here.
You have a plasma wavelength.
So what we need to get universality, we need to explore the technically speaking the infrared behavior of your theory.
In fact, in the standard Casimir, at high temperature, you enter the Lipschitz regime, and the dependence on the force is exactly that, linear in T.
But that one is due to dimensional reasons, because your fundamental scale at high temperature
is due to dimensional reasons.
Yes. No, but the problem is that now what you have in here, so here you have universality for two reasons, because you have the handle to play with a length, that is the correlation length, that you can make much larger than any detail. It's at your will. I mean, of course, within theory.
Fisher's electrodynamics of a massive photon.
You can take the massive photon.
You will get the scaling function.
Yes.
The plasma frequency corresponds, or the inverse of plasma frequency corresponds to L microscopic.
This object here, yes. Actually, I forgot to tell you something. The analogy I presented you some couple of slides before, I presented you as an analogy. Actually, this is not an analogy. I mean, in some cases, you can establish a rigorous mapping. When you do quantum electrodynamics and you introduce simplification like you consider a scalar field, in a sense, you are going to consider a Gaussian theory, and the Gaussian theory is also used to describe the behavior of some critical system. So if you want electrodynamics with mass, it's nothing but Gaussian theory with a finite correlation length. But it's important to have in mind that universality arises when you can explore the infrared behavior, that is actually tautologically saying that you are going at scales which are much larger than microscopic details of your system. Microscopic details are, for example, the plasma frequency. Okay? So the idea then is to look at this to investigate this universal behavior here, okay?
Can we take this analogy further and say that the dynamic Casimir force, if you're oscillating one of the plates, would there be a similar analogy between
the two? No. The dynamics, I mean, I'm going to tell you something at the very end about dynamics. Dynamics here is something different from dynamics in the Casimir in quantum electrodynamics, because these are effective models. What I'm going to tell you, to describe phase transition, you use effective models. And the dynamics of the effective model has to be prescribed on the basis of other kind of considerations. While in quantum electrodynamics you have one Hamiltonian, and this Hamiltonian is giving you statics and dynamics. So in this sense, the problem is different. Okay, then maybe then there are some points of contact and things like that.
But in Abbot's Gauss, you also have a Hamiltonian. And the dynamics is the dynamics of
the
excitations.
Yes, I mean, but when you focus, okay, you can translate, in some cases you can translate it, but it's not obvious, okay? So, in the sense, for example, when you study other kind of systems, you can have the same Hamiltonian, but with two different dynamics. I will show you later.
Physical excitation, not propagation, diffusion excitation.
Well, it depends. It depends because if you no, because you can look at models with conservation, like model B, then also you have a conserved order parameter. So, okay, so let me. Okay, so the question is, we have been talking about these Casimir forces. How large are they? Okay, probably you know this estimate much better than me, but again, for pedagogical reasons, let me summarize. If we assume that we are able to take two parallel plates of 1 cm², at a distance of 1 micron, and Diego, I mean, is going to tell us that this is dreaming, because it's basically impossible to keep two parallel walls of 1 cm² at a distance of 1 micron, okay? But if we assume this and we calculate the typical magnitude in quantum electrodynamics, we end up with 10 to minus 7 newton, more or less. And if we do the same in statistical physics, assuming to have a critical temperature or room temperature, you get a force which is more or less comparable, okay? So we are talking about forces of this order of magnitude. Okay, you have to keep in mind that here you have a different dependence on the size of the system. But is this force terribly small? Well, actually not quite, because, for example, if you take a water droplet of half a millimeter of radius, its weight is somehow comparable. But anyhow, these are small forces. So, for example, if you start reducing this area, this force is going to die out very quickly. Now the question is, how can we probe, how can we measure this force? I mean, for example, when you do it in quantum electrodynamics, one of the large, most famous problems is the alignment between the two walls. Actually, if we want to probe these forces in statistical physics, we have a natural way of getting alignment. That is, alignment between the two walls, that is via wetting films. So I will briefly recall you, I mean, of course...
I don't mean to be materials-based here, but could you go back just a second? If I have such a distance between two plates, I'm looking at wavelengths characteristic of that distance. I'm looking at frequencies that are thermally excitable or not. There are a lot of things going on that tell me I shouldn't be using this in the first place.
I know. But, I mean, if assuming that somehow you can kill these material-dependent properties, this would be the universal part you are interested in. Or if you want, you have to go at 2 microns.
Well, we're looking at photons of fairly low energy in this distance, aren't we? So
yeah, in these... In the,
even some temperature coming into here, isn't
there? Let me... I mean, this was the calculation assuming that it's at zero temperature.
This is still, I think, Steve Lamoureux has... is working at these distances, not for plates, but sphere plates.
Well, as we know from previous talks, there's lots of worrying going on in that subject right now.
Okay, no, but look, I agree with you. I mean, I'm simply evaluating the universal part. Actually, the finite temperature correction might be, I mean, they can change this estimate by 3, 4, 5, in terms of factor, not by 300. I mean, of course, if you go to smaller scales, then the correction is going to increase. But at 1 micron, I don't know, I mean, the experts are here, at 1 micron, the finite conductivity correction should be like, I don't know, 5, 7, 10, okay?
You get the finite conductivity at 1/10 of the plasma wavelength.
So okay.
Let's say, plasma wavelength for 100 nanometer for gold, or 10 nanometer for gold.
No, 10 nanometer for a gold is too low much. I don't remember, but I mean, anyhow, this is going to be not 10 newtons, okay? Just this was my message. So now the problem is, how do we get alignment in statistical physics? I was telling you, Diego, don't smile. Well, I'm making the things simple. I know. I mean, I'm conscious. So wetting fields. What I mean, already Raphael and Professor Chan said something about wetting fields. But let me again tell you briefly what I mean by that. Okay. So imagine you have a fluid, and this is the typical phase diagram as a function of pressure and temperature. Okay, you fix the temperature, and you go at a pressure which is very close to the condensation transition. So you have in a room a vapor at temperature T0, which is slightly undersaturated, okay? Now what happens is that, so imagine you have the room with this vapor, okay? Now it might happen that when you put this vapor in contact, so you introduce in your system a substrate, a wall, it might happen that thermodynamically the formation of a liquid layer in between the vapor and the solid substrate is favored. In a sense, the interaction with the wall is providing a sort of extra pressure to condense the vapor on the wall, okay? This is not the condensation that you observe in the shower, eh? Because in that case, this is a different temperature compared to the vapor, so this is an equilibrium configuration, okay? And in some cases, if the material is chosen properly, it might happen that the thickness of this wetting layer diverges upon approaching the pressure at which you would expect, at which you have coexistence, okay? This is the so-called complete wetting. And you see that you can make microscopically thick films, because it's enough to get close to get a layer which is large enough. Okay, and what we have achieved here, and the position of this interface is basically due to the competition between the undersaturation and the van der Waals forces. Okay, what we have achieved here is parallel plates, as you can see, because we have now a liquid which is confined between a substrate and an interface with the vapor, okay? Now, if we are able to induce somehow critical fluctuations on this liquid, there is a chance that we will observe something related to the Casimir force in this geometry, okay? So the idea is now that you don't confine physically with the walls, but you exploit the interface with the substrate and the interface with the vapor as confining mediums. Okay? So we have solved the problem of alignment, because these two interfaces are aligned by construction or by definition. But of course we are neglecting something, that in general you expect capillary waves occurring at the surface. So this surface is not flat. But if you go far away from the critical point, this should not be a serious limitation. Okay. Now the question is, we have to find a substance which has a phase transition within the liquid phase, and far away in this region of the phase diagram. And I mean, probably one of the best studies, example substance which have a liquid phase transition is the helium.
I have a question regarding the first one. Well, you know that Capasso is trying to do this, the standard Casimir, putting a liquid that has an epsilon in between the two materials.
Yeah.
Is so epsilon 1 less than epsilon 2 less than epsilon 3, so you have this alignment in the Casimir. The same happened here? I mean, what? What's the epsilon of this vapor, and what's the epsilon of your substrate?
You should ask him.
Vapor, one.
Yeah, let's say if the vapor, yes.
Yeah.
But remember, here we are interested in the critical Casimir force. So we are going to, what we need the fluctuations in here. So we are not looking for repulsion. Actually, if we would set repulsion here, we've got a repulsive Casimir force, then this vapor is going to be unstable. This liquid is going to be unstable. Because remember, here you get stabilized by the competition between van der Waals forces, that if you are in the retarded regime, that is, if the film is thick enough, the Casimir force of quantum electrodynamics, and the undersaturation. Okay? So, I will say...
The real answer is, you do something really disgustingly ugly, you measure it. You measure the probability of the liquid, and then you make the theory. Because the different liquids have different properties. And you're going to get switching over. That's the whole point of the Capasso strategy. I'm working with them on that right now. We're just looking at very particular liquids to see...
But this is not the conditions which I'm going to put.
But he's asking you, do you know those conditions hold?
No. I mean, what I know is here the van der Waals interaction is the normal one. I need to have stability. I'm not playing with the properties of these two objects in terms of epsilon. I only did this trick to form a liquid, a layer, a wetting film. Okay? Now, once I have the wetting film, I will play with this liquid.
Well, I think you know for helium that you can be confident that the inequality is working in the direction that you want, right? But you could certainly find substrates that would change the inequality.
But I think he doesn't care about what the inequality is.
Exactly. Right. Actually, no. In the situation in which I am, because I mean, if I would have different, if I would have repulsive van der Waals forces, then this liquid layer is not going to be stable in my case. Huh? Meran, do you agree?
It's the other way. I think you meant it the other way. I think you meant it the other way.
Yeah.
If it's attraction, it pushes the stuff aside.
No. Wait. This distance here, the thickness is...
Graphis layer even away from the critical point.
I'm away from the critical point, but I'm close to the coexistence.
From a critical binary.
I mean, if you want, we can discuss later on. You can write an interface potential, and you will see that basically this is the competition between the non-retarded van der Waals interaction and the under-saturation. It's a matter of calculating free energies.
Trying to produce condensation in the liquid.
So either we discuss later, or if you look in the there were a couple of slides by Dietrich who was explaining.
You are still away from the critical.
I'm away from the critical point. Of the vapor, I mean, we have several critical points. I'm away from the liquid gas critical point. I need to have a film, because if I go here, there is no film, okay?
Yeah, also you're away if it's a binary liquid. You're away from that critical point.
If I'm a binary liquid mixture has several critical points. It has the mixing point and the liquid vapor critical.
Also away to start with.
No, I will show you later on. I will go.
Yeah, you move into that point, but to see the Casimir force. But you.
But remember, I'm looking at the Casimir force, which is due to the confinement of critical fluctuations. I'm not interested in the one in quantum electrodynamics. And this is just a mean to achieve a confined liquid layer. But we can discuss, because this is always a point of discussion. So one of the best examples of system which has a liquid-liquid phase transition is the helium. Okay? As you know, there is a solid, you have a liquid phase, you have a vapor phase down here, and for a fixed pressure, when you increase the temperature, you go from a superfluid behavior to a normal behavior. And the universal properties of this phase transition along the lambda lines, so that is the normal superfluid transition, exploiting the idea of universality, were described by the so-called XY lattice model. Okay? So this is a minimal model which has the same gross features, if you want, of the actual transition, which can be used to study some properties of the universal properties, actually, of this phase transition. Okay? So now the question is, can we get a wetting layer out of this? Yes, because if you look carefully in this area of the diagram, we have exactly what we were looking for. We have a superfluid and a normal fluid, and the line of critical point is ended up at the critical end point. Now what happens if we prepare the vapor of helium at this temperature, and we choose a proper substrate, and for example it's copper, as this was a result this was basically the setting which was somehow used by Chan. When you prepare it on copper, you get condensation of this layer. You are here. Now the question is, when you move, you change your thermodynamic parameters, and you move in this direction, the onset of critical fluctuations in the liquid layer. So the liquid layer is going to undergo this phase transition. Okay? And as a result, the fluctuation, of course, have to be confined in the space between this surface and this surface, and the confinement of this fluctuation is going to affect the equilibrium thickness of this film. Okay? So the idea is, by looking at how the thickness of the film changes when you go in this direction, that is when you pass close to the critical end point, this is when you induce a phase transition here, by looking at that you can reconstruct the Casimir forces, okay, if any. So the force due to the confined fluctuations in here. Okay? And do you agree? Okay. And of course, we have to understand in terms, this is what happens physically, what happens in the model, which are the boundary conditions for the order parameter. Because I was telling you before, boundary conditions are going to be important because they also determine the universality behavior. Okay, the order parameter here is the fraction of superfluid. And of course, so it's basically a wave function, quantum wave function. In the copper, the wave function of the superfluid is zero, here is zero, and the vapor is zero, so by continuity it has to be zero at the boundaries, okay? So the boundary conditions for the order parameter are Dirichlet in this kind of geometry, okay? Now we have all the setting. We know what we can study. We can study the XY model, which is a lattice model, which can be used, for example, for Monte Carlo, which is suitable for Monte Carlo simulations. We know the boundary conditions. So what we do, instead of doing the experiment, we go in the computer center and we do a Monte Carlo simulation. It really simulates the easy model in a three-dimensional layer of finite thickness. Then we have problem, of course, in getting the infinite limit in this direction, but you keep the thickness finite, and you can calculate the Casimir force, okay? And the scaling function, particularly. So the scaling function. So here, what I show you is the result of Monte Carlo simulations for the XY modeling with Dirichlet boundary condition. The scaling function as a function of the, I was telling you, usually you write the scaling function as a function of the ratio between the size of the system and the correlation length. Alternatively, you can write like this, the scaling variable associated, which is basically this the quantity I was telling you before to some power 1 over nu. You see, basically this is the correlation length. And you use the exponent nu. And these are the data points that you get. And you see that qualitatively you get attraction. So the force is negative, it means attraction. At low temperature, it saturates to a plateau because you have Goldstone modes. And
how big your system in flame?
Okay, here you see these are the thickness is from 10 to 20.
Yeah, and in plane it's...
This one was for an aspect ratio of 4 or 5 times larger. I mean, of course, it's a problem when you do Monte Carlo simulation. And the fact that this data corresponding to different thicknesses of the layers in which you do the simulation collapse to a reasonable extent on the same curve is a good indication that you are getting scale. Okay? These are our Monte Carlo data. Similar results were obtained by Huth. There is a lot of physics here. I mean, here, Roya, Mehran. Here there is still some interesting behavior, especially when you compare to experiment. Okay?
I know this picture up there is just a cartoon, but is this right to imagine that there's some healing length where this order parameter goes down that's very small compared to the actual length? So the order parameter here should be roughly flat among most of the distance between
here.
Them.
Here actually there is no room for an healing length. I mean, now if you go to microscopically, but in general I would say if it goes to a finite value, I mean, when you do this infrared behavior, this asymptotic behavior for large thicknesses, it doesn't matter if it goes to a finite, to a small value or to zero value. So it's a matter of fixed point boundary conditions, okay? So when you can compare...
You're doing a Monte Carlo simulation and you're extracting a free energy.
It's not easy.
I know, that's why I'm asking the question.
Yeah.
It's a non-trivial thing to do.
Yeah, we were...
Say how you're doing it.
Actually the work was to devise a method to do it. Basically we are using the coupling parameter approach. So the problem is you have to reduce the difference in free energy, which is not an ensemble average, to an ensemble average. And we do it. I mean, if you want, we discuss the detail later. I mean, and you have different methods too. This is what we are doing, and the Hucht is using another method. But we get more or less, we get within error bars the same results. Okay? And now we compare with the experiments of Rafael, Professor Chan, and you see that the agreement is quite satisfactory. Here I was telling you that, yeah, there is still discrepancy between Monte Carlo data and theory, and between Monte Carlo data and experiments. There have been some theoretical suggestions how to heal this discrepancy by Mehran and Roya, but the debate is still open. There is a small piece missing down here. But more or less the physics is this one, with the deep minimum and so on. And some of the features of this deep minimum can be already captured within a mean field approach, as again, Mehran, Roya, and also as in Stuttgart we found, okay? Okay, so now the question is, okay, you see, these exponents, basically this Casimir force, the magnitude of this force is scaling like the temperature. Huh? The scale is set by KBT. And here we are working at a temperature which is of the order of 2 Kelvin. Huh? A first step in making this force larger, that is also easier to measure, is to find a mechanism like this at high temperature.
Excuse me, how were these experiments conducted?
You have the experimentalist sitting next to you.
I presented yesterday, but maybe the slides are on the web yet. What we did to measure the film thickness was we actually had 2 plates of copper, and you measured the capacitance.
Plates.
And from the capacitance and from knowing the vapor pressure, you back calculate the thickness on the plates.
This is where capacitance measurements are going to show you, for example, things obtained by X-ray reflectivity. Okay. So let's go back to our old binary mixture. Okay. So we have also another system which has a phase transition within the liquid phase. That is the binary mixture I was showing you before. Huh? There is this transition between a homogeneous phase and a separate phase. And we know, thanks to universality, that this can be described by the EASY model. The critical point of this phase transition are those of the EASY model. And what about boundaries? As I was telling you before, typically a boundary will prefer one of the 2 components. That is, will enhance the value of the order parameter. So when you have 2 boundaries like this, 2 parallel boundaries, you can have, for example, the case in which the 2 boundaries like the same component of the mixture, and the order parameter is going to look like this one, or they can prefer different components of the mixture. So the order parameter is going to look like this. Okay? You can play, you have a freedom doing that by playing with the material properties, okay? So, and again, we have the EASY model. What we have to do is just to study the EASY model with the same algorithm as before in a finite thickness, in a layer of finite thickness. And here I report the value we got for the scaling function as a function, again, of this proper scaling variable with the proper critical exponents, both for the case plus plus, that is the same preferred component, or plus minus, different component. And we observe 2 qualitatively different behavior, okay? In the case of plus plus, the force is always attractive. It decays to zero at both high and low temperature. Why? Because at high temperature, the correlation, both at high and low temperature, the correlation length is small. That is, the range of force is small. And while you achieve repulsion, when the boundary conditions are different, you see? You get, and also the magnitude is different. I mean, there is a factor of 4 or even more between these 2 factors. Okay? So we have an easy way of achieving repulsion, and again you see that the data collapse is a good test of the fact that we are in the scaling regime.
Same X definition on both graphs? Or?
Yes. This X has nothing to do with the boundary condition. This is a bulk property.
No, I mean before you had the opposite.
No. Okay. Here, because this I put it because this is a lower critical point. Actually, for the EASY model, is upper critical point.
But I mean, you use it also for the plus minus, the same X definition on
yes.
The reinverted one again.
No. These are the same. Actually, wait a second. Here is written in order to make the comparison with the data for the binary mixture. If you do for a Monte Carlo simulation here, you should have the opposite, minus 1 minus T divided TC. Okay? So here is, this X is positive when you are in the disorder phase, and is negative when you are in the ordered phase, in the bulk, of course.
So right here, if you go to large negative X, the collapse would stop? because you have an interface that plugs in.
Here we have, why I cut it here? Because here we have Monte Carlo, we have problems with statistics, because the simulation is becoming hard for that reason. And actually, the fluctuation of the interface is also telling you why you have such a big difference in the overall magnitude. Because here you have also the contribution of the interface to the force.
Do you also get a phase separation in that regime as you lower the temperature?
Remember that what you have to do is to stay...
Sorry, I'm still confused. Is negative X on the right plot lower temperature or higher temperature?
Lower or high depends if you have upper or lower critical point.
In your case, no.
This graph is done in such a way, X positive corresponds to disorder phase, and X negative corresponds to order phase, which is in the easy model on a lattice in the computer means high temperature, low temperature. For a binary mixture, this means low temperature, high temperature. For a binary mixture with a lower critical point. If you have a binary mixture with higher critical point, this is again high temperature, low temperature.
So in that context, for negative X, you would expect phase separation. Right, you should have an A-rich component.
You see, the problem, this is a pro. I mean, the problem is in which regime you are actually. Here you have to stay, you have to stay with a correlation length which is large enough, but it's still in the proper ratio with the correlation length. And then anyhow here you have what do you mean by phase separation? Here you have always some sort of phase separation because of the boundary conditions. You have always preferred, one component here, the other component here. Oops.
Discuss later.
Yeah. Okay, so, and now comparison with the experiment, which was also part of the things that Rafael was showing you. So these are the experimental data obtained by Fukuto Pershan by using the wetting layer of this substance, methyl cyclohexane and perform methyl cyclohexane on a quartz substrate. So they did a wetting film, they measured the film thickness with X-ray reflectivity, and from here they extracted the thickness of the film and the Casimir force, okay? And this is the comparison, okay? So we have evidences for repulsive, if you want, critical Casimir forces. It's over here. There has been some preliminary studies, but there are still some problems, okay? And experimental studies. Now the question is, as I've shown you so far, the way we are getting evidences of the forces is quite indirect. In the sense we have to look for an equilibrium between, we have to look at how these forces acting of the liquid-vapor interface are going to change the thickness of the wetting layer, which is nice. I mean, we go also to some quantitative results, but it's difficult. So what we ask ourselves was, okay, do we have a more direct way of measuring these forces? Okay? How would you measure a force directly? Okay, in principle, you take a dynamometer. This is how you do it at home. It's like a dynamometer. You put the object there, and then according to how it stretches, you measure the force. Unfortunately, you cannot do it here so directly because we are talking about very, very small forces. We are going to talk about... Yes?
Shouldn't I expect that, this minimum in this first graph, it shouldn't coincide with T equal TC, so X equals 0?
Actually not. There is no way, no reason why it should.
Okay.
And actually, it does not. And how are we going to, actually, you see that here is the other side. So the idea is, how are we going to do it? Well, we can do it, because there is a phantom Newton dynamometer available on the market, which is called total internal reflection microscopy. But to go to the total internal reflection microscopy, we have to change geometry. Instead of considering two parallel plates, we have to consider a sphere in front of a plate. Okay? So let me assume that we have a plate and a sphere of a certain radius r, and the separation, surface-surface separation, is z. And if the radius is much larger than z, one can use, then we can discuss later. You can use the Derzhagoin approximation or proximity force approximation, and you can use the previous the results I showed you before for the scaling form of the Casimir force, and you can translate them in this case, and this is the resulting scaling form, where this scaling function here can be calculated in terms of integrals of the Casimir of the scaling function of the Casimir force calculated within parallel plates, as usual. I mean, proximity force approximation is allowing you to translate the results for parallel plates into sphere plate geometry, okay? And this valid reasonably well when this condition holds, okay? So, and now how do the total now I'm going to give you the introduction to total internal reflection microscopy as seen from a theoretician, okay? The total internal reflection microscopy has the capability as the resolution of 1 femtonewton, I mean, let's say 5, 10 femtonewtons, okay? Which is performing much better than the poor Cavendish. This is obvious, I mean, it was long ago. But it's also typically better than any atomic force microscopy. So it's a very sensitive method, which is not new. I mean, it has been applied for many studies of interaction between colloids in soft matter physics. And how does it work? How does it work? So can you see the sketch here? So what you do, you take a particle, a colloid, a typical radius of 1 micron, and imagine you have this colloid in a mixture, or let's say, no, sorry, in a mixture, in a liquid, in a generic liquid. So there's this colloid, and this colloid, because of the size, is going to undergo some Brownian motion. Okay? So the idea is this one. The idea is to monitor this Brownian motion, and how you do it? You produce via total internal reflection of a laser beam, you produce an evanescent wave in your medium, and if it's an evanescent wave, typically decays exponentially with the penetration in the liquid, or let's say with the distance from the surface. Now what happens is that if the index of refraction is properly chosen, a colloidal particle sitting in this evanescent field is going to scatter light out of the evanescent field. So this is what I represented here. And if you then collect the scatter light with a photomultiplier, you get a scatter intensity. And then experimentally it has been found that the scatter intensity, also with some models, scatter intensity is proportional to the value of the evanescent field at the distance z. Okay? So if you measure as a function of time the scatter intensity that you measure at the photomultiplier, actually what you are getting, if you invert this direction, is nothing but how the distance of closest approach changes in time. So basically, you are monitoring the Brownian motion of your particle. This is a sketch, but actual signals really look like this one. Okay, and therefore, if you do the statistics on the VME, if you take a finite a record of a finite length in time, and you do the statistics, you can calculate the probability distribution function of the z as a function of z. And we know, if this is an equilibrium system, all the things are at the same temperature, this probability has to be given by the Boltzmann factor. And this is telling you, basically, this is giving you a way of measuring the potential of the forces acting on the particle. Or if you want, if you take the derivative, the force. Okay? So now we have a method, which is also particularly nicely suited, because we are talking about small forces, and to see a small force, you need, in general, small particles. So, and actually here, what you need is a small particle. So this is perfect setting to measure Casimir forces.
How do you measure the distance, the absolute distance?
This is a problem, because, of course, this is basically left undetermined by the total internal reflection microscopy. If you want, it's related to the normalization factor. We use an hydrodynamic approach. That is, we know theoretically how the hydrodynamic diffusion coefficient should depend on the distance from the wall. Then we measure the hydrodynamic diffusion coefficient, we fit it with the theory, and we get out the absolute value of the distance. It's complicated. I mean, I'm trying to make, as I told you, all the details you can find in Dietrich's lectures, or we can discuss later on.
Remind us, maybe he said it, what is typically the length of these excursions?
These excursions, well, actually, I don't know in terms of Z, but it's like, I mean, let's say the typical, these, I will show you. Actually, no, I know, because I will show you later. If I don't tell you, you ask me again. So what we have done, actually what I showed you, basically what you do with total internal reflection microscopy is nothing but a Monte Carlo simulation. If you think carefully, it's nothing but a Monte Carlo simulation of the potential phi. Okay, so what we took was a mixture of water and lutidine. This is lutidine, for chemists. This is for chemists. And the phase diagram of water and lutidine looks like this, the room pressure. So it has a lower critical point. And you see the critical point is at 34 degrees, so we don't need to go in terrible conditions. So the concentration critical value position. For this phase transition, you can take as order parameter the local concentration of lutidine. So from now on, what I call plus is going to be an excess of lutidine, and what I call minus in terms of boundary condition is going to be a depletion of lutidine. And what I'm going to show you is what happens when you fix the concentration of your system at the critical value, and then you rise the temperature towards the critical point. Okay? So first of all, when we are far from the critical point, somewhere here, you can measure the interaction potential in terms of KBT as a function of the distance Z, as I showed you before. And what you see generically is that you have an electrostatic repulsion at very small distances. I mean small, I mean the order of microns, of 0.1 micron. Then you have a gravity. Why gravity? Because of course the particle is feeling also buoyancy. In addition, actually, we don't have not only we have also, in addition to gravity, also additional force exerted by optical tweezers. Optical tweezers is just a mean to keep the particle there, because otherwise it's going to drift everywhere. And these optical tweezers are providing extra pressure. So this is the typical shape of the potential away from the critical point. And given that the gravitational part is common to all the curves that I'm going to show you, I will subtract it. From now on, you won't see the gravitational tail, but you will see only the electrostatic part. Then, okay. Also, from now on, I've subtracted gravity. Okay, now what we have done, we have taken our colloids of 1.2 with a radius of 1.2 microns and put it in front of a wall, in which both of them, they don't like lutidine. So this is realizing the so-called minus-minus boundary conditions. And so here, these are the results of the potential as a function of the distance as you approach the critical point. So let's start from here, so the black curves. This is far away from the critical point, where far away here is basically 300 millikelvin. 300 millikelvin far from the critical point, you see the gravitational, you see the electrostatic repulsion, and then you see nothing because I've subtracted the gravity. The question is, which Adrian is going to ask me, where are van der Waals's? It's a problem. We don't see them. Because a possible addition of van der Waals forces should have been seen here. That's life, okay? Now you get closer to the critical point, you see, you increase the temperature, you see that there is an increasingly deep minimum developing. You see it basically that there is an attractive contribution which growing upon getting closer to critical point, which in conjunction with the repulsive electrostatic part is giving you a minimum. And the curves, I show you, I mean, and then we can assume, for example, that the electrostatic repulsion is negligible from this distance on. And therefore, what you see from here on the right, it has to be a contribution due to these critical Casimir forces. And these, the black curves are the comparison with the theoretical predictions. And you see that this is very good.
Would you be able to see van der Waals forces if you have a repulsive Coulomb force present?
Well, in principle, you still have a sort of a tail.
But the Coulomb force has a longer tail, isn't it?
No, I mean, this is the by screening length.
Okay.
I mean, this is screen. Of course, you are in a system with ions, okay?
For the contribution of gravity, do you always calculate the same slope, or for each curve, potentially, you just cut off the linear part separately?
It makes actually no difference. Actually, it makes a very, very small difference. But I think I think this was 1 by 1. But anyhow, you know, the difference is very small. No, it's not clear, but actually, it turns out to be very small. Actually, the buoyancy, if you want, in principle, depends on the order parameter profile around, but it makes not such a huge difference, because the difference in density is not terrific. Okay?
There is no electromagnetic interaction except probably the Coulomb interaction.
If you want to put it like this, usually here you would expect some van der Waals. Huh? We don't see it. Why? Well,
again, sorry. I mean, the liquid is lutidine, and the particle is
polystyrene,
and the surface
silica glass. I mean, there is this is something that I can say, but actually it's not so it's not a direct justification. There is an almost perfect index matching between the two.
Yeah,
but actually, if you think carefully, it's not enough in principle to conclude that you have no, because the index of refraction is of the optical frequencies. Huh?
I think according to the DLVO theory, both the electrostatic and van der Waals become mixed together. Like the double layer interaction and the van der Waals interaction, they assume a common shape for particles in solution.
Well, it depends. I mean, there is this question, zero frequency contribution, higher frequency contribution. They are mixed, but we have one of the world's experts.
So these data are for one particular combination.
Yeah, this is for the polystyrene of one, and this is the only thing changing here is temperature.
The solvent is a mixed one here, or this is just a pure?
No, it's the water diluted in mixture at the critical concentration, which is
0.29. So you just find that particular one here.
The thing is, depending on the particular salt that came with the lutidine, you can change the electrostatic interaction part with the van der Waals part to just be almost any shape.
I mean, you can, yeah, actually, yeah, I mean.
So that may be why you're not seeing it. I'm just saying.
No, in principle, for example, actually, at the very beginning, we tried to think about putting it by hand the salt.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a mess.
It's a fixed amount of salt that just came with.
Yes. Yeah. If I remember correctly, it wasn't.
It should be okay, because you're not interested in that part of the interaction. You're interested in the bundle.
No, but in principle, I mean, the idea would be, let's see if we can shift this by changing the by screening length. We can play a little bit. We tried. I was not doing the experiment by myself. Of course, we were discussing with the colleagues, and they said, it's easy to say, it's difficult to be done. Huh?
I guess you're comfortable with the idea, and I don't see anything against the solvent is mixing fairly nicely, and that whatever electrostatic property, dielectric constant, whatever,
is already dead here.
It's comfortably, boringly fixed.
Yeah.
And I guess you measured that separately anyway.
Yeah. Actually, what we obtained, I mean, there were already measures by Bezan, I think. I don't remember by whom, but we checked that the by screen length is compatible with what is published. 12 nanometers. 12 nanometers.
12
nanometers,
0.012 on this scale.
Yeah.
Oh, so it's really
screen numbers. Yeah. So, and then you see from here, dice, huh? Yes, what else? Okay, and here forces are around 600 femtonewton, typical forces. I mean, actually, the maximum forces associated should be 600 femtonewton, Casimir force, okay?
Where exactly salt goes into preferentially the water, the lutidine, is anything exotic that goes on?
This is something we are working on. Because here we are assuming that the medium is homogeneous, but the medium is not homogeneous.
This is one of the Michael Fisher as well. It's strange.
Yeah.
Extra long.
It's not easy because, I mean, if you have to put in salt, you know.
Which the Stillinger sum rule gets violated.
We are working on it because, I mean, this was the zeroth order approximation. Huh? As usual, first you do the zeroth order and then you go beyond. So now, so this was realizing, and you see that the agreement with theory is nice, so we have attraction. And also qualitatively is nice. No, sorry, quantitatively is nice. Now we change the colloid, so we keep the same, you see, we keep the same substrate. We still doesn't like too much water, and we change. And we change colloid, and which the colloid of a different radius, which doesn't like, for his own reasons, which particularly likes lutidine. So this is going to realize anti-symmetric boundary conditions. And again, when we are far away from the critical point, and here far away is again 900 millikelvin. We see we are left only with the gravitational repulsion. Electrostatic repulsion. It would have been nice to have seen a gravitational repulsion. Okay, so there is electrostatic repulsion. And when you increase the critical temperature, you see that this repulsive part is shifting towards larger values. This is telling you that there is the onset of an increasingly strong repulsion, okay? And again, you compare it with theory and you see that that the agreement is nice. I've cut here the comparison here because for larger values of the potential, the sampling of the particle is poor, okay? So you were asking about the excursion. I mean, basically this is the typical excursion of the particle, because the excursion of the particle is telling you where you are able to measure the potential, because the particle has to sample the potential, okay? Okay, so that basically, in this sense, we think that we have done the first direct, in the sense I was explaining before, so the most direct possible evidence for both attractive and repulsive critical Casimir forces. So, in terms of conclusion, okay, I hope I convinced you, but probably there was no need of convincing you, but that whenever you confine fluctuation with boundaries, you get effective long-range forces, or you get effective forces which might be long-ranged. And there is universality in if you explore these effective forces at the proper scale. Huh? These are length much larger than microscopic scales. Okay? So what I was telling you before, now is the critical Casimir effect, but there is a tricritical Casimir effect, as Raphael was discussing yesterday and the 2nd of September, Professor Chan. And also here, I mean, this is the phase diagram of an helium-3-helium-4 mixture, which you can observe this tricritical Casimir effect. Also here, we have experimental data by them and also theoretical prediction by us in Stuttgart, okay? And again, the agreement is reasonably nice. So this is just to tell you that there is life beyond the critical point in this sense, and perspective. Of course, now what I've considered so far has always been the case of homogeneous surfaces. Huh? Everything is nice, smooth, and flat. Now the idea is you can start considering non-homogeneous surfaces, both from the chemical point of view and the topographical point of view. Huh? For example, you can take two surfaces in which the preferential absorption of the substrate is chemically modulated, and you can, for example, displace them, and you expect to have also a lateral Casimir force, huh? As you get also in quantum electrodynamics. You can have a lateral Casimir forces if you have a corrugation which doesn't match. Or you can explore geometry like non-spherical particles, and you get a torque. And these things are already known, for example, for liquid crystals. There has been several contributions. You can combine both of them, explore both geometrical and chemical aspects. Or you can study, for example, very, very interested would be to understand the many-body properties of the force, because you know these forces are not attractive. Huh? The many-body properties. Part of this work in this context have been already done by people in our group Stuttke. Okay? And in terms of just to show you some nice pictures and what you can do, I mean, if you would like to play with these forces, you can again study stripes for one single particle, and this is actually has been done by the group of Clemens Beckinger in Stuttgart, experimentally. So the single particle, but then you can play with many particles, like here, and study how these particles. If you want, you can. If you are particularly imaginative, you can think about even applications. Because remember, what we have achieved, a force which can be easily switched on and off with very small changes in temperature, which is not the typical case in soft matter physics, in which if you want to achieve a change in the potential of the order of in the previous curves you saw that we are talking about changes of 6-8 kBT, which is huge. If you want to do it by changing salt concentration, you have to put more salt than liquid. So in this sense, we have a very fine way of gauging this force. So this is a possibility, for example, to study how this particle localizes upon changing the temperature on this corresponding stripes. You can study chessboard and things both at the level of single particle, many particles. You can study, if you are interested how you can exploit these forces to orient ellipsoidal particles. Imagine at high temperature you get something like this. When you get close to a point, they will try to align on the corresponding substrate. Okay? Or you can study, for example, the problem of transport. Imagine that you have a substrate which is chemically treated in a continuous fashion. And then you put particle on one side because of this thermally switchable Casimir force that will try to reach the corresponding part. Okay, so this is just possible applications. Okay. Then from the theoretical point of view, there is the whole issue of equilibrium and non-equilibrium dynamics. Part of the story we have heard last week from Andreas Anke. Andreas Anke was considered the case in which you have a fluctuating medium. Actually, what it was considered was a critical medium when you change the distance of the particle. The distance between the two walls, and it was looking at the reaction. What you can do, and this is what we have done in Stuttgart, for example, is consider the case in which you fix the geometry, but then you change the thermodynamic conditions. As I have shown you, if you are far away from the critical point, the two walls, they shouldn't feel any critical Casimir force. While when you tune at the critical point, you have to have a critical Casimir force between the two walls. And what I show you here is what happens, for example, when you take two walls, one with Dirichlet, the other with Neumann boundary condition. So you have a Dirichlet-Neumann boundary condition system, the Casimir force. The critical Casimir force is repulsive, repulsion. In equilibrium, the force on the two walls is exactly the same because you are in equilibrium condition. So you have no way of distinguishing which one of the two walls is Dirichlet and which one is Neumann. But then what you do is you take this system and you put it at a temperature which is far away from the critical point. So the two walls, they don't feel any critical Casimir force, because the correlation length of the fluctuation is very, very small. So they don't see each other. And then suddenly you quench the system and you change the temperature and you tune it right at the critical point, or the bulk critical point. So you expect that as a consequence of this thermal quench, the critical Casimir forces have to build up in time. And this is what you get. First of all, there is a universal kind of behavior, so you can express this dependence of time via a proper scaling variable. And this is the value of the scaling function as a function of time. So if you want, how the intensity of the Casimir force changes in time, normalized by the value at equilibrium. And you see that you have two qualitatively different behaviors at the Dirichlet and at the Neumann wall. Of course, at the large times, they have to converge to the same value. Of course, at time equals zero, you have zero force. But you see that the way they build up in time is different. So you have, if you want, a dynamical way of distinguishing which one of the two walls is Dirichlet and which one is Neumann. Okay? This has been done, this is a calculation I've done for the Gaussian model, and basically with the same setting somehow that was used by Andreas Anke and the same assumptions. And otherwise, you can study, for example, the case in which you have two volts, you have a fluctuating critical medium in between, and you make an external perturbation, like you can imagine, like a field or an excess of I mean, this actually was done if you for Dirichlet boundary conditions. And at a certain moment, you apply a field which is changing locally. You apply an external field which changes locally the order parameter, and then you observe how things relaxes. And you can study the stresses, for example, on the two walls. This has been done for a perturbation which is localized closer to this wall than to this other wall. So this is a snapshot for a given time. So you perturb the system, you observe the relaxation. At a given time, you measure stresses, you find a distribution like this. Okay? Then the stresses propagates and so on. So, I mean, the dynamics is a whole new chapter, which poses also some interesting conceptual problems. And then there is the whole business of things in which, for example, capillary waves, in which you confine not the fluctuations of interfaces. Like, imagine you have a substrate, let's say the interface between two fluids, and you insert two colloids which are pinning the interface. You can study also here a sort of effective forces induced by fluctuations. This has been done for colloids by these people. And also, I mean, if you think this is also related to some of the things that Anya Machowek was saying here in August, and also things that she has done together with Douglas Abraham, who is in the audience. Okay, in terms of application, apart from those I showed you, we have a fine gauge to change the interaction between colloids. So you can imagine about assembling, disassembling colloidal crystals, which can be used, which in principle could be used for photonic applications. And then there is these things. I mean, if you want, these objects could even be thought as being used for as an anti-stiction devices for MEMS. Okay, just. Was sort of futuristic application. Of course, I have to acknowledge lots of people. First of all, the theory group of which I'm part in Stuttgart, the experimental group of Clemens Bechinger in Stuttgart, where they carry, I mean, the experiment with total internal reflection microscopy, and other colleagues with whom we have collaborations for the theoretical aspects of critical cosmic force. And I thank you for your patience.
Since you're using material properties, I guess the reason you chose this particular combination of, I mean, I never would have thought a priori what this combination would be.
Because it's studied.
What's behind it? Yeah.
Because it's particularly well studied.
And is there a strategy for looking at those solvents?
Yeah. It's particularly well studied because it's also one of the combination which an anomalous aggregation of colloids was first observed by Bézanne et al. So they use that system and they observe this anomalous classification. And our explanation is that, I mean, in that case it's unclear because they were in a phase, I mean, they were observing it in a region phase diagram in which you can have many things at play. So they were here. So you can have wetting. But then we saw, let's see, with the same system we can see critical cosmic forces. So staying at this critical concentration, we are sure that we are not hitting pre-wetting or like wings which should be located somewhere here, okay? So we use that one. Also, lutidine is one of the few substances which is tabulated and actually it's not in your book, but
Well, I'm interested.
You can add it the next edition. Yeah.
In dynamics, was it possible to separate the order parameter dynamics? Just forget about the
laws of the this is one of the challenges, because you see that actually this data here is also telling us about dynamics. And when you do dynamics, in principle, first of all, you cannot use simple models like model A, model B. Relaxational models are of no use. You have to use models which also accounts for the presence of conserved quantities, basically coupling critical behavior to hydrodynamics. And then what happens? Well, this is a problem. I mean, I'm working also on that, but it's really hard. But then you have to couple it to the system. And to the these inhomogeneities in the system is complicated stuff. So, I mean, this is a necessary step because in principle from here we can measure, for example, the dynamics of this force, equilibrium dynamics.
Thank you.
Food.